This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest this hour has accomplished a lot in a very short amount of time. A Charlotte native, he graduated from the University of North Carolina in 2011 with a degree in peace, war, and defense, and received his master's from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He quickly applied all of that education by going to work for the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan in the U.S. Department of State in Washington and the Special Representative for Somalia at the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya. He's held other positions at the Department of State as well. And now, at the old age of 25, he's written 102 Days of War, a book that tells the story of how Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and the Taliban survived 2001. Yanni Barzilai joins us for the hour from the studios of NPR in Washington. Welcome to the program, and welcome back home.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
As I was doing the preparation for this, I was going to ask you how much of what appears in this book is sanctioned by the State Department or the Department of Defense or the White House or other players in this scenario, and how much of it is yours?
Sure. Well, all of it is my own. The State Department and the rest of the U.S. government has had an opportunity to review it. But my opinion expressed here and in my book are my own opinions and don't necessarily reflect the U.S. government or the State Department's opinions.
And we should point out that you are working for the State Department right now. So
that's correct.
Your book is about what happened, as I said, in the first 102 days after the 9/11 attack, the American response to that attack. Where were you on 9/11?
On 9/11, I was in Blacksburg, Virginia, and I was in middle school.
Middle school.
I was in seventh grade. And it was a pretty incredible moment. I remember class pretty much stopping, somebody coming in and whispering to the teacher that something had occurred. And we eventually turned on the TV and watched what had occurred for the rest of the day and went home.
Yeah.
But I don't think I ever really was able to understand the magnitude of it being in seventh grade. And part of that curiosity has actually helped me in trying to go back and understand what occurred and it motivated me for writing the book as well.
I was going to ask you why you chose to write about this particular period. This war has been going on for, it seems like, forever now. But we waged two wars in the aftermath of 9/11. Why did you choose to focus on the first 100 days, 102 days?
Well, it started out with the fact that I had discovered that Osama bin Laden was located by the U.S. government on December 10th, 2001, to within 10 meters. And we had a number of special operations forces in the area as well. And I was shocked that we missed him, essentially, and that al-Qaeda had survived. It led to the broader question of what happened in 2001, how did Osama bin Laden survive, and what was the broader context of al-Qaeda and the Taliban's survival and escape into Pakistan? One question led to another, and ultimately the book was created.
That 10-meter figure, when I saw that, was shocking. Is that common knowledge, or is that something you uncovered?
It is not common knowledge, but it is something that's out there. The top special operations commander on the ground has written about it in his book, and it's something that I've mentioned in a number of places. And also, I think the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has pointed that out as well.
Hmm. I want to come back to that later in the conversation. You grew up here in Charlotte. You went to Myers Park High School. You attended UNC Chapel Hill. And when you look back on your childhood, your time in school, can you see the path that took you to where you are today? Can you see traits that you may have displayed as a young person that you used to drive you toward writing this book or to the career path that you're on right now?
You know, I'd like to say so, but unfortunately, I actually really can't. I was a math and physics major when I started the University of North Carolina in 2007. Math and physics and science in general was always my strong point. And I really disliked history and I disliked writing. So it was the exposure that I had at the University of North Carolina to really good historical scholarship and to the analytical process that really started making me interested in history and politics and world affairs, and also some of the opportunities I had to travel while at UNC.
You know, a lot of kids today don't see a lot of value in history. It's dusty, it's boring, it's dates and facts and figures, and you see it in a completely different light, and you see it as not only helpful but necessary to people in power. Talk about that.
That's correct. Well, when I learned history in high school and middle school, it was a lot of facts and a lot of memorization and just dates and figures. But what I learned is that it's much more than that. History really is the opportunity to look back upon changes in our society and in our world and put everything together in an analytical framework. Every history has some sort of analysis in it, unless it's really just a number of bullet points. But more importantly, we can learn a lot from history. Now, as a historian at heart, I need to point out that context is everything. Taking lessons from history without looking at the context and the broad circumstances under which they occurred is inappropriate. But with that in mind, leaders can learn a lot from history. There's everything, almost every decision and every sort of issue that has occurred right now or that's occurring right now has occurred in some shape or form in history. And so it makes only sense, and it's really the responsibility of leaders to look back upon that and make sure that they're deciding things in an appropriate fashion and not making the same mistakes that other individuals have made.
But you believe that there's a partnership, or there can be, or maybe even that there should be, a partnership between academics and military leaders and political leaders when we're talking about things that have gone on in the past. And I'm just curious why these leaders would need materials published in the popular press or in academia to learn lessons in their own areas of expertise when there must be literature in those departments, like the Department of State, the Defense Department, within the government, that give them historical background or institutional knowledge of what came before. Why do they need the popular press?
There absolutely is that information available, but on a day-to-day basis, it is so difficult to escape just being mired in what's going on and the amount of information that's already available. I can tell you that when I worked at the State Department, and as I continue to do, I receive hundreds of emails a day, just an overwhelming amount of information. And I'd say the same thing occurs at exponentially higher levels as you go up the chain of command and up the ranks. So the opportunity that academia and that the public press has is to provide relevant information in a way that isn't necessarily being portrayed to leaders at the current time.
I know you've only been with the State Department for a short amount of time in the scheme of things, because you are 25 after all, but have you found that there is an appetite, or that sort of information from outsiders is welcomed?
There is a tremendous appetite for it, I think. Part of the thing that is the eternal tension between government and academia is that academia always tries to talk about what should be occurring in the grand scheme of things. And government really looks at what's going on right now and what's realistic.
Because
there's often a gap.
I got to tell you that we did a lot of shows about 9/11, and as the as this war on terror, as George Bush called it, was launched, we did a lot of programs trying to understand what provoked that 9/11 attack, and understand Iraq, understand Afghanistan, understand the Taliban, and all these things, and countless academics told me that they had things to offer to the government, knowledge, because this was their area. They spent their life. Some of these people were near retirement, and they had spent their life studying these parts of the world and little minute details about these parts of the world. They were never asked about that knowledge. They were never asked to share that knowledge. I found that kind of striking.
It absolutely is. I think that it's a responsibility of leaders to be looking for information from all domains. It's very easy to get tunnel vision and to only receive the information that you want to receive from one narrow pipeline. And part of the responsibility of those leaders is to really look beyond that, because we are, you know, as diplomats, as people who are in the U.S. government, we are representing the United States of America and not just the U.S. government. It's very important to make sure that we are listening to American society at large and have a pulse on the American people.
You really had to want to write this book.
That's absolutely true.
Because the process of getting this book to the bookshelves where people can actually buy and read it was a slog. You point out that the manuscript went through an 11-month pre-publication review by the Departments of State and Defense, the CIA, the White House National Security Staff, in order to prevent disclosure of classified information. And they redacted seven of what you call thematic features. But you point out that everything in the book, indeed everything they redacted, was obtained from open sources and on-the-record interviews. And some of what they wanted redacted can still be found in your undergraduate honors thesis, which resides in the Wilson Library at the University of North Carolina. And you point out that they wanted the name, for instance, of the Navy SEAL team that conducted the raid on the bin Laden compound in Abbottabad, redacted, even though it has been known publicly for years. So why then did they want this information redacted if it's readily available?
That's a great question. And to be honest, I don't have the answer to that. What I can say is that overall, I think that it was a pretty balanced process. There were many frustrations, and there are things that they judged to be classified or asked me to remove that I did not agree with. But put that into the broader context of the United States. I think what other country in the world would allow a young diplomat to write about sensitive military and special operations and intelligence operations in a critical narrative, or at least at times critical, and continue to remain in government in the same position? That's pretty incredible if you think about striking the balance. Mm-hmm. Now, in this specific instance, I disagreed with a couple of the issues, and each organization provided different levels of response. The CIA initially redacted a number of materials that I appealed, and they gave it back. So I thought that was really the right thing. I put all the sources down. I put together a comprehensive appeal, and they agreed with me. The Defense Department was much more difficult, but their redactions were much more narrow, and they're under a much more stringent set of guidelines about what's classified and what's not. Mm-hmm. Even though something may be in the open domain, it doesn't mean that U.S. government officials can necessarily talk about it. And I understand that perspective.
So had you not been a member of the diplomatic corps, could you have talked about it?
Yes.
Really?
And that's exactly why all that material is in my honors thesis at UNC. Now, to point it out, these are really minute details that ultimately were redacted. The name of the SEAL team that conducted the Abbottabad raid, a specific unit in the Army Special Operations Forces, things like that. They're actually all out in the public domain because I found out about everything for the book by reading and by interacting with others. So it all is open source information. And I wouldn't say that, luckily, I would say that my readers of the book will not necessarily lose anything due to those redactions.
So the classified information that was in there, and I said it all came from open sources. How is that possible? How do open sources get classified information? And did you have a security clearance that allowed you access to classified information for the purposes of doing your job?
I do have a security clearance. It is solely for the purpose of doing my job, and it is not necessarily actually, I've never had any exposure to classified information on the subject of my book. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when you're talking about how I got access to that information, again, a lot of it is open source. And I can actually tell you a funny story. The Special Operations Command publishes a history about some of its activities. And in that, there's a map of what occurred at Tora Bora, which is the topic of a good portion of my book. And I had contacted the Special Operations Command History Department, and they provided me with that map so that I could republish it. And part of that map actually ended up becoming redacted as it came back through the Defense Department's clearance process. I think that's, you know, it's an error. It's almost comical. But the reality is that different organizations and different institutions within the U.S. government have different perspectives on what should be classified and what shouldn't be. And that's where this whole debate ultimately comes from.
Yonav Barzilai is a diplomat. He's also the author of the book we're talking about, and we'll get into the details of that book in a few minutes, 102 Days of War, How Osama Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban Survived 2001. We're taking a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and My Fox Carolina's Primetime on WJZY. It's interactive, informative, and new. My Fox Carolina's is on TV, on mobile devices, and on the web at myfoxcarolinas.com. Well, the 22nd Winter Olympics kick off tomorrow night in Sochi, Russia, but the location of the Games has given us, well, a lot of concern over possible terrorist activity. We're going to speak to the Russian ambassador to the United States tomorrow about those concerns and more. And then we're going to go to the Mountaintop. That's a Broadway play which imagines the last night of Dr. Martin Luther King's life. It's at the Booth Playhouse through the beginning of March. And we meet the cast tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, hormone use by men has risen dramatically in recent years, but new study shows older men taking testosterone could be at greater risk for heart attacks and strokes. The safety of prescribing testosterone.
You can join the discussion on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is a native Charlottee and went to Myers Park High School, went to UNC Chapel Hill, and is now a member of the U.S. Diplomatic Corps. His name is Yaniv Barzilai, and he is the author of a book about our first 100 days after the 9/11 attacks. It's called 102 Days of War, How Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban Survived in 2001. What he talks about in the book and what he talks about on this program do not represent the views of the United States government, the State Department. They're strictly his own. Your book, though, has been described as brilliant, insightful, remarkable, and essential by one of your teachers at Johns Hopkins, who is also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and who was in the White House Situation Room on September 11th, 2001. His name is Bruce Riedel. He wrote the foreword to your book. That's really high praise.
It is, and I really appreciate that praise. I only hope that the book lives up to it.
Bruce Riedel, who's the fellow we're talking about, served in the George W. Bush administration. He's also written his own book about the search for al-Qaeda and says that your book demonstrates that bin Laden's escape at the time was due in part to confused thinking in the White House and the Pentagon about war aims, strategy, and goals. And further, he says, confusion over what we needed to accomplish in Afghanistan was evident from the beginning of the war and prevented our commanders on the ground from achieving all that they could have. That confusion and drift started at the top in the White House. Those are his words. You agree with that?
I absolutely do. It's important to contextualize that after 9/11, it was a very, very difficult time for the leaders in the White House, the Defense Department, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the State Department, the rest of the U.S. government in general. But as they come together to determine what the objective should be in 2001, as they go to war in Afghanistan, there is a lack of understanding of what really is at stake and what needs to be done. When they determine the ultimate objective, they never actually come to a consensus. What emerges and what the president's understanding of the objectives was to remove Afghanistan as a safe haven for al-Qaeda. Now, that is a fundamentally different objective from destroying al-Qaeda, dismantling it as an organization and as a threat to the United States, and going after its leadership. And that seemingly simple distinction had really vast operational, strategic, and historical outcomes.
I don't know how you spend most of your time in this book talking about Tora Bora, which was the effort to remove al-Qaeda or disperse al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and perhaps to kill him if they could have found him. But we seem to first go after Iraq, which it turns out really had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks, and the weapons of mass destruction that were alleged to have been there were never found. Why the focus on Iraq? Why didn't we just go right into Afghanistan and stay in Afghanistan until we had taken out al-Qaeda?
Sure. Well, there are a number of things to address in that question. The first is that Iraq comes up immediately after 9/11, and it's pretty much dismissed as something that is not relevant. In the first week after 9/11, particularly at Camp David on September 15th and 16th, the only advocate for going to war in Iraq as an immediate response to 9/11 was Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz. And the president actually gets pretty upset with Wolfowitz when he raises this at Camp David and tells Condoleezza Rice and his chief of staff that Wolfowitz should not be intervening and talking about such things like that again. After Kabul falls in mid-November of 2001, there is a renewed look at what's going on in Iraq and the war plan. And part of it is that when they decided upon the scope of the U.S. war effort, they decided that they were not going after a war against al-Qaeda. This was not a war just against the Taliban. This was a war on terrorism in the sense that it was a war to prevent all other attacks against the United States worldwide. within that framework, it is somewhat logical to perceive Iraq as a terrorist threat. Now, if you actually look at who perpetrated the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, Iraq has nothing to do with it. But again, this was not framed as a war against al-Qaeda. It was a war on terror.
And one of the problems, one of the reasons, I take it, for the confusion about which way to go and what exactly to do and how to pursue or respond to the 9/11 attacks is that this came as a surprise and there was no plan of attack that was simply on a shelf somewhere waiting to be implemented in case of an emergency. There was no break glass if in case of emergency plan sitting there. But really, it was a complete surprise that al-Qaeda was out to get us? A complete surprise?
It was not a complete surprise. And in fact, the Central Intelligence Agency had been warning the president and the rest of the U.S. government that, as I quote from George Tenet, that the light was blinking red. There was a profound sense that an attack was going to come from al-Qaeda. Unfortunately, the challenge that they had was to determine what type of attack it was. So within the intelligence community, there was a strategic understanding that the threat was occurring and that it was relatively imminent. Unfortunately, they were never able to get any sort of details or tactical operational understanding of what was happening.
And is that why there was no plan? Because it's of no use to make a plan that is so vague that it could be implemented for almost any purpose. It needs to be more detailed than that. You need to know who the enemy is, where they came from, where they are, how to get them. Is that why there was no plan?
To a degree. I think part of it is that that warning was coming from the intelligence community, and particularly the Central Intelligence Agency. Mm-hmm. The people who put together the plans are actually in the Defense Department.
Right.
And the Defense Department did not have the sort of connections, understanding, intelligence, or anything else about Afghanistan that the CIA had. So when President Bush actually convenes the cabinet to talk about what's going on and how to respond after 9/11, the Defense Department has absolutely no plan aside from a list of some already empty targets in Afghanistan, while the Central Intelligence Agency comes in with a comprehensive plan to attack al-Qaeda across 93 countries across the world and to go after al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan.
Has that changed given the fact that we now understand, I think, and I don't think we understood this before 9/11, we now understand, one hopes, that the nature of the threats to the United States are no longer the same as they were during the Cold War. They've changed now because we are in this world where individual actors can do things that are previously unthinkable. So have we changed that? Is the Defense Department more nimble than it used to be?
I think it absolutely is. The Defense Department has done an extraordinary job of responding to the threats that are occurring around the world. I don't want to speculate on exactly what exists because, frankly, I'm not familiar with that well enough to tell you. But I think that we've seen, since 9/11, an extraordinary transition in the Defense Department to be able to respond to threats incredibly. And I think that the Osama bin Laden raid in Abbottabad perfectly demonstrates that.
As somebody who's embarked on a career in the State Department, talk to me about how the State Department views its role now. Because in the past, diplomats and members of the diplomatic corps interacted with other countries, with foreign leaders and people on their level in those countries to try to understand those countries, make friends with those countries, make connections with those countries to keep the peace and to be aware of roiling undercurrents that perhaps our government should be aware of so that we could respond to them. But when we're talking about individual terrorists who have no connection to a nation state, what role does the State Department play?
Sure. I actually really can't answer that very well because I'm not a spokesman for the State Department. And I think it'd be inappropriate for me to undercut anybody there who has a better perception of what occurs and what the State Department's role is.
You are a diplomat, aren't you?
I am a diplomat.
You urge citizens who scratch their heads over the disorganization and the lack of a clear mission in those days, which is those words are coming from people who were actually in the administration, to step back and try to empathize with those conducting these efforts to go after the masterminds of that 9/11 attack. Why should we empathize? What were they going through?
They were going through an extraordinary moment in American history. It was the most devastating terrorist attack that has ever occurred on the United States. And it was actually, I believe, larger than the Pearl Harbor attacks in terms of the amount of deaths. More importantly, this was an attack on civilians, and it was quite unexpected. So the notion that the individuals in the White House and the leaders of the United States government were going through an emotional challenge would be a tremendous understatement. Mm. After 9/11, the threshold for what intelligence and threats were being received by high leaders went substantially down. So they were suddenly seeing incredible amounts of threat information. Threats appeared to be coming from everywhere, every day, and they had no idea if a follow-on attack was occurring.
Yeah, we tend to forget the white packets of the packets of white powder that were being delivered on a regular basis to leaders around the country.
Absolutely, and that was just one part of it. Mm-hmm. Another story is that one day in, I believe, October, the White House finds out that the biological detectors go off, and they test positive for botulinum. Botulinum is one of the most deadly poisons and biological agents in the world. I think a 1 gram vial, if properly spread, can kill about 1 million people. And so on that day, Vice President Cheney is actually at the 9/11 sites in New York City and receives the call that they need to start planning for the continuity of government, because if this test is not a false positive, everybody in the White House will be dead within 48 hours. So it's an extraordinary challenge to understand. Luckily for them, and luckily for the United States, that was not the case. It was a false positive. Mm. But can you imagine being a leader after 9/11, suddenly discovering that you may be dying, the president may be dying, and everybody in the White House who is responsible for leading our nation through these devastating attacks may be dead in 48 hours.
So that's going on, and of course, you mentioned in your writing that, and we tend to forget this too, that the people in charge in the State Department, in the Defense Department, in the White House knew a lot of the people who died in these attacks. So they were coping with that on top of all these things that were going on and the fear of the absolute unknown of what was happening and who was perpetrating all of this. You interviewed 13 U.S. officials who presided over the U.S. war in Afghanistan. How did you choose those people, and did anyone turn you down?
I chose those people because I tried to talk to everybody I could who played some role in the U.S. war effort, whether it was planning or being on the ground in Afghanistan. Some people did turn me down. I think I list four or five in my book, and those were along the likes of General Tommy Franks, who was the commander of CENTCOM, and General Hugh Shelton, who was briefly the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Ambassador Hank Crumpton, who was the deputy director of the CIA's counterterrorism center. But I did get to speak to a lot of people in very similar roles, and they provided a tremendous amount of insight and a lot of new information, which I tried to put in the book as much as possible. Mm.
Among the individuals that you talked to were former White House National Security Advisor, at least at the time of the 9/11 attacks, Condoleezza Rice, Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, Undersecretary of Defensive Policy Douglas Feith, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, and others. How did you gain access to these people? You just pick up the phone and call their people, and they let you in to interview them?
Believe it or not, more often than not, that actually worked. I did have some connections to some high-level officials. Some were working in think tanks, and I was able to email them. And then some of them, I literally picked up the phone, called their office, like Condoleezza Rice. I called her office and asked if she would be willing to do an interview. And I think that's a testament to the public servants that I interviewed, that they are there not only to help the United States during that enormous crisis, but that they are willing to talk about it and to talk to nobody like myself, who is an undergraduate student at UNC working on an honors thesis or a paper at the time, and engage in a very frank dialogue about what occurred and retrospectively look upon their own errors and their own successes.
Classified material, was any question off limits? How forthcoming were they?
They were all quite forthcoming, actually. There were occasional times where individuals said that they'd rather not comment on mm-hmm. a specific issue, but I was shocked and impressed at the candor that they each gave me and the amount of time that they gave me.
How did you fact check them?
I cross-referenced it with the memoirs that were available. I asked other individuals in interviews, And I really just tried to dig into the details. There's a lot of information out there, but it's in very different places. And the opportunity to be able to ask three or four people about the same issue gave me the ability to really cross-reference and fact-check.
So this book began its life as an honors thesis, and then you decided to expand it into a book. How much more work did you have to do? How many more people did you have to talk to make that happen?
Well, when it was an honors thesis, it was about a little less than 100 pages. So I had to double the length, essentially, to turn it into a book. I took that opportunity and that time to interview as many people as I could and to get as much information and advice as well. I don't actually remember the exact number of interviews I'd done before during the honors thesis versus when the book came about. But I would say that I probably did twice as many interviews after I got the book deal.
You say that you tried to avoid political partisanship in the book and to be objective about the people you interviewed and about whom you write, but you still work for the government. Can you be completely objective? Can you afford to be completely objective? You have to go back to work.
Sure. I mean, to be completely honest, I don't think anybody can be completely objective. What I tried to do is to let the history tell the story, to let the individuals themselves tell the story, which is why I put block quotes and long quotes from the people that I interviewed as often as possible, because I believe that they can tell the story better and the readers can then draw their own conclusions. But I think that it's important to be objective. I am not a politician, and I think that the people who work in the national security apparatus are not politicians. They are policymakers or policy implementers. Our responsibility is to make sure that we're doing the best thing for the United States, whether or not that is politically the appropriate path. Now, the political calculation should be done by the president and his political staff, but that's not something that I have any role in.
Yeah. Our war in Afghanistan has gone on now for more than a decade. It took us until May 2nd, 2011 to capture and kill Osama bin Laden, and yet you say that our failure to destroy al-Qaeda and kill bin Laden was not only the result of failed tactics, but the product of failure of policy and leadership. Whose leadership? Which policies?
Sure. So in 2001, when the United States had cornered Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan at Tora Bora, really at the border with Pakistan, it was an extraordinary opportunity. And I've talked a little bit about the tactical failures, the fact that we only had 93 troops on the ground when 800 had been requested and another 1,200 themselves had been asking to go over to reinforce the American troops. But the policy failure, as I mentioned, was defining the war in Afghanistan's goal as removing Afghanistan as a safe haven for al-Qaeda. That essentially is dispersing al-Qaeda over somewhere else, such as Pakistan, and making it eternally more difficult to destroy al-Qaeda. I want to point out that at Tora Bora, there were most of al-Qaeda's leadership that to this day remain the leaders.
I want to come back to that because I think that's an interesting point, this dispersion of al-Qaeda rather than the destruction of al-Qaeda, which caused us and will continue to cause us problems, I suppose, going forward. But we have to take a break. Yaniv Barzilai, the author of 102 Days of War, is our guest, and we're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Business North Carolina magazine, covering the economy, industry, and business of North Carolina each month. February introduces a new design for the magazine with subscriptions online at businessnc.com and at the App Store. Well, hormone use by men has dramatically risen in recent years, but a new study shows that older men taking testosterone could be at greater risk for heart attacks and strokes. So Diane Rehm and her guests will take a look at the safety of prescribing testosterone coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about our efforts to get Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan in the early days of the war on terror, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great place to start, and we will continue our conversation in just a moment. Stay with us.
Once upon a time, it was kind of quaint to live near the railroad tracks.
I used to be kind of comforted thinking I live in a town with little choo-choo noises and horns at night, but I don't think so anymore. I hear those choo-choos and I hear danger.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. More oil is traveling on the tracks, meaning added worry for the people living near them. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Yaniv Barzilai, a Charlotte native U.S. diplomat, is with us. He's the author of 102 Days of War, How Osama Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban Survived 2001. let's talk about this. The military had 8 days to come up with a comprehensive and executable war plan in the days after 9/11. Did we rush into a response unnecessarily? Could we have taken more time? Would that have mattered in the face of an unclear objective? I mean, what was the objective after those first 8 days and the plan was in place?
Sure. The objective was to remove Afghanistan as a safe haven for al-Qaeda. But everybody understood that differently. Whether or not we rushed into the war effort, it was a largely improvisational effort that was based partially on intelligence and partially on what was going on the ground. Whether or not that would have been successful had we taken more time, I really can't say because there's so many different outcomes. Mm. It was a brilliant plan of attack. It worked extraordinarily well against the Taliban. And from the end of October, when all the resources in Afghanistan were in place, it took only 14 days to topple the Taliban. So that in that sense, it was very, very effective. It was not effective in going after al-Qaeda and destroying it as a terrorist organization.
Well, in fact, you write that they told the military to expel al-Qaeda from Afghanistan. But why not destroy it? If they can run the Taliban out, why couldn't – and they were 10 meters from Osama bin Laden, why couldn't they destroy it? Why wouldn't they want to?
I think that there was just a different understanding of what was going on. Certainly the individuals on the ground – viewed al-Qaeda as the main enemy, but there were only a couple hundred Americans on the ground. And within the White House and within CENTCOM, which was the central command, the military command running the war, there was a lot of other things going on. They had to weigh going after the Taliban and going after al-Qaeda against what resources were available. And they saw the extraordinary success against the Taliban and didn't necessarily understand that that did not translate in the same way as destroying al-Qaeda.
Is that because we maybe still are, woefully ignorant of that part of the world and don't really understand all of the intricate details of the politics of that and the undercurrent of thinking that goes on in that part of the world?
I think at the time we underestimated the nature. We underestimated and did not understand very well what was going on in Afghanistan. But I don't think that necessarily should translate into failure to go after al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. We knew that al-Qaeda had attacked the United States on September 11th. We knew that Osama bin Laden was the leader. And we knew that between 1,000 and 2,000 al-Qaeda leaders had retreated to Tora Bora. It's just a 6x6 square mile area. I mean, it's probably the size of metropolitan Charlotte or uptown, mm-hmm. or metropolitan Charlotte in general. That small area, or less really even, had contained almost every al-Qaeda leader that not only was a leader then, mm-hmm. but today runs al-Qaeda. People like Ayman al-Zawahiri and Nasir al-Wahaishi and Saif al-Adel.
Well, Washington, D.C. is 10 square miles. So the city of Washington is 10 square miles.
Yes.
So that wasn't much smaller than D.C. You detail a meeting in the counterterrorism chief's office at the CIA on September 19th, 2001. That's 8 days after the 9/11 attack, in which Kofor Black, the chief of the CIA's counterterrorism center, issued orders on behalf of the president for a special operation into Afghanistan in which he told operatives to kill, not capture, bin Laden and his leadership. And you quote him as saying, "They must be killed. I want to see photos of their heads on pikes. I want bin Laden's head shipped back in a box filled with dry ice. Have I made myself clear?" I think so.
Yes.
Is that what the
he
president
certainly did?
Is that what the president wanted? Is that what Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, wanted? I ask you because you also quote Rumsfeld as telling officers not to make too much of bin Laden.
That's correct. I think they both wanted, President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld wanted that outcome, but they were never willing to elevate it to the level of it being an objective of the war. Part of their justification, as they claim, is that the war was not about going after simply Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden was one leader within one terrorist group within a much broader threat of terrorism. And so, as I detail in the book, there are these extraordinary quotes from Secretary Rumsfeld, from Paul Wolfowitz, and from Doug Feith saying, do not over-elevate the importance of al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden is only one man, and don't necessarily focus on that. In hindsight, that's an extraordinary thing to think about. I think it's a failure to understand the threat that we were being faced with on September 11th and the months after.
In an NSC meeting on November 15th, the day after Kabul fell, you report President Bush as saying that weapons of mass destruction targets took precedence over securing the Afghan border with Pakistan and that if bin Laden moves elsewhere, we're just going to get him there. Which actually seems prophetic in retrospect, because in fact he did move and we did get him. But you go on to say that President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld's biggest mistake in the opening months of Operation Enduring Freedom in the battle at Tora Bora was their failure to examine and intervene in the affairs of the military. You call it a dereliction of duty. That's pretty strong wording. Is that your opinion, again, or the opinion of those you interviewed? I mean, whose opinion?
That is entirely my opinion. What I would say is that the president and secretary of defense were fairly engaged in what was going on in Afghanistan in 2001 up until Kabul fell. After that, they actually start looking closer towards Iraq and dusting off the war plan. But just as Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda are cornered in Tora Bora, the president and the secretary of defense disengage almost entirely. Now, for President Bush, that was generally the way that he handled the military in the earlier half of his presidency. He became much more involved within the military affairs later on. Secretary Rumsfeld, it's quite uncharacteristic of him. He was so in the weeds of the military in October that he actually put so much pressure on General Franks that General Franks threatened to resign because he thought that Secretary Rumsfeld had lost confidence in him. So that withdrawal from what's going on at Tora Bora is quite extraordinary. And I want to point out as well that it's hard to understand and hard to imagine that a Secretary of Defense and President who were engaged in what was going on and who really understood and asked the questions necessary would allow the United States to continue to go after Osama bin Laden and most of al-Qaeda as they were cornered, with only 93 American troops relying largely on untrustworthy Afghan rebels and no reliable force to seal the border.
Well, I'm confused now, because you say that President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld kind of took a hands-off approach to this and didn't check in with their military or, I guess, intervene in the decisions of the military, and yet you point out that we went in there with 93 troops when 800 were requested. Who requested the 800? Who denied the request?
The Central Intelligence Agency's top operations officer on the ground in northeast Afghanistan was Gary Bernson. And as they were tracking Osama bin Laden to Tora Bora, they quickly realized that it would be very easy for bin Laden to escape and go over into Pakistan. Gary Bernson calls his supervisors at the CIA, mainly Hank Crumpton, and requests 800 Rangers. He also calls General Franks, and he calls around pretty much as possible to get 800 U.S. Army Rangers to go in to Tora Bora and block the escape routes. The Rangers weren't the only resources available. General Mattis, who was commanding about 1,200 Marines near Kandahar, actually requested as well to General Franks to move his forces over to Tora Bora and make sure Osama bin Laden escaped. They were all denied. It is my understanding that it was largely coming from General Franks at the time. There's a question about whether Secretary Rumsfeld and President Bush were ever aware of the request. Now, again, General Franks may not have brought that information to them because General Franks was confident in his perspective. But it's a failure of the leadership of President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld and those on the National Security Council not to examine the issue more closely. My understanding was that they were only getting weekly or biweekly briefings about what was going on in Afghanistan. They were aware that a battle was going on at Tora Bora, but they did not ever engage in what's going on a daily basis at the level of detail necessary.
Condoleezza Rice wrote in her memoir that President Bush tended to accept the military's representations not unquestioningly but with fewer probes than he would make later in his presidency, at least in the early days of the war. That's what he did. And that sounds actually very much like Abraham Lincoln and how he conducted the Civil War. He constantly had problems in the early days of that war with his commanders in the field not doing what he thought they should do or letting them do what they needed to do, and yet they were constantly failing. So is that a dereliction of duty, or can you chalk that up to inexperience in the early days of any presidency or to leaders simply letting other leaders below them do their jobs without being micromanaged?
Sure. There is a balance that's absolutely necessary. And just like it's not a good thing for the civilian leadership to overengage in the details and become micromanagers, it's important that they don't disengage as well. When something is so vital to the United States that it's a vital national security interest, civilian scrutiny is absolutely necessary, but it has to be judiciously used. I think that President Bush was largely inexperienced at the time, and he gained a tremendous amount of experience as he grew through his presidency. If you look at the way that he handled the surge in Iraq in 2006, he did so by understanding what was going on in the military. He listened to his military advisors who were telling him that transition was the appropriate path, and he actually overruled them, which is pretty extraordinary, and it was the right decision. It reduced the levels of violence in Iraq tremendously. And so the contrast between the way that the president handled the military at Tora Bora in 2001 and the surge in 2006, I think, is emblematic of his growth as a president.
Hmm. Had we captured or killed bin Laden in those early days, or even decimated al-Qaeda's high command during the Battle of Tora Bora, how would that have changed, do you think, the years that followed and our security position in the world today?
There's a real question about whether al-Qaeda, as we know it, could have survived had it been destroyed at Tora Bora in 2001. Unfortunately, no one will ever know what the outcome would be. But we can say with some level of certainty that the nature of America's role in the world, the nature of our military engagements abroad, of the threats that we face from al-Qaeda and other terrorists around the world would be substantially different than they are today.
Yaniv Barzilai is our guest. He's a U.S. diplomat. He's the author of a book called 102 Days of War, How Osama Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban Survived 2001. Matt emails, please ask your guest about miscalculations on winning the peace. Perhaps the Department of Defense, which has recently embraced a new doctrine, has a richer future. Specifically, could we have brought the lights back on in Iraq sooner? Has learning occurred?
Learning is constantly occurring within all levels of the U.S. government. After 9/11 and after the United States topples the Taliban and pushes al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, the United States committed relatively little amounts of resources to securing the peace in Afghanistan. We promised Afghanistan something along the lines of a Marshall Plan. That was the term that President Bush had used in a speech. And we did not follow through in that same light. And if you look at the number of troop levels in Afghanistan in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, you're looking at 5, 10, 15,000 American troops for a massive country with incredibly diverse and difficult terrain. And if you contrast that to Iraq, which is much more conducive to warfare, we had 100, 120,000, 180,000 troops in Iraq. Now, that opportunity in 2002, 2005, when the Taliban and al-Qaeda were largely not threats in Afghanistan, was a missed opportunity for the United States to bring Afghanistan to where we wanted it to be.
What does your book tell us about Pakistan and their role in providing cover for al-Qaeda in general and Osama bin Laden in particular? And did our government or our military ever truly believe that we had a reliable partner or friend or collaborator in Pakistan?
At high levels, the United States government, I think, did believe that we had a reliable partner in Pakistan in 2001. After 9/11, the view generally was within the Bush administration that Pakistan had swiveled on a dime. Now, I view that 180-degree pivot that was perceived more like a 45-degree tilt. And Pakistan played a very important role. After 9/11, they war-gamed what it would be like to oppose the United States, and they determined it would not be feasible. And I should point out that 9/11 occurred at the height of the operational relationship between the Taliban, al-Qaeda, and Pakistan's inter-services intelligence. So after Pakistan decided to swivel and to support the United States, it did remain close to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban afterwards.
And later in your book, I'm running short on time, I want to get this in. Late in your book, you compare the Battle of Tora Bora, where you say we pretty much knew where Osama bin Laden was located but failed to get him, and the day of his death in Abbottabad. We weren't really sure on that day that he was actually there, and we were sending in two helicopters. And that was a risk, particularly if he wasn't there, had the operation failed. You say that the comparison between these two operations reveals important insights into the role of presidents in war. Talk about that briefly.
Yes. Again, the situations were vastly different. 2001 was an enormous crisis, a mobile situation and dynamic situation that could change every day. President Obama, when he was dealing with the Abbottabad raid, had the luxury of time and not being in a crisis. Nevertheless, I've talked about how President Bush handled the military. President Obama intervened at all levels within the military and engaged in the matter at hand at a very close level. He actually specified and directed the military to provide four additional helicopters on the Abbottabad raid. Two would stay within Afghanistan, two landed in the middle of nowhere in a riverbed in Pakistan as emergency support in case something went wrong. And as it occurred in Abbottabad in 2011, on May 1st, the first helicopter that was landing crashed. Mm-hmm. And had we not had those emergency support ready to come pick up the SEALs in Abbottabad, there would have been no way to get them out, and it would have been a tremendously difficult incident.
In 20 seconds, one of our Facebook listeners wants to know, can you give some actionable advice to those interested in becoming a Foreign Service officer?
The test is available to anybody between the ages of 21 and 45. I think it's a great opportunity. Try again. Read what's out there, and just make sure you read the news every day.
Yaniv Barzilai is a diplomat. He's the author of 102 Days of War, How Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban Survived 2001. The words in that book represent his opinion and not those of the government or the State Department. Thank you for the hour, Yaniv.
Thank you, Mike. It was a pleasure.